Thank you, Chief Justice Kennedy and Associate Justices. It is a privilege to be here before you in this off-site court. May it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Can you, Counselor, move the mic a little closer to you? Thank you.
Thank you. Your Honors, this is a case about statutory interpretation and the plain meaning of the statute in question. What we have here, Mr. Hickman was found not guilty by reason of insanity over 40 years ago. He's been in the state hospital system ever since. He has been in the state hospital system since he was 17 years old. In 2022, he was up for review of those conditions of his confinement, and at that time, the trial court found that adjusting his conditions and granting him release from a hospital to a monitored group home that has 24/7 nursing care was inappropriate. And the trial court did that without any contradictory evidence introduced by the prosecutor at that hearing. The statute is clear. It says that all hearings under this provision require the state to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the requested change is a danger to any person or to public safety.
Counsel, the Court of Appeals in this case did find one error on behalf of the trial court judge. Is that correct, that this your client was needed further treatment for the condition he suffered? Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that relates to the prescribing of Abilify as a prophylactic measure for Mr. Hickman for Del Mar. And in his specific case, Dr. Goldberg testified at length that it was a prophylactic measure in an attempt for the hospital to make Del Mar more palatable for release from the state hospital system to the trial court. And according to his testimony, that medication could be summarily discontinued without any negative impact to him or to the community at large.
So what are the strongest facts that supported, that were offered in evidence on behalf of your client that would tend towards granting the level that was requested, the less restricted level of supervision?
So for the first and strongest fact tending to grant this for Del Mar is that for over 17 years now, he's already been on unsecured status. He's already been granted level 5 movement privileges from the hospital, where he is allowed to leave the hospital
by himself
without a chaperone. He has successfully managed public transportation in the Canton Maslin community. He went to work at Goodwill for several years without fail in his conditions. He returned to the hospital successfully. He maintained that employment. He only lost that job when the operation changed hands. It was not through any fault of his own, not through any employment history that he had with them. It was simply because new management didn't want to keep him.
And no episodes of violence whatsoever.
Dr. Goldberg did reference at least one, to my memory, incident with a peer at that, where ultimately Del Mar left the facility and returned to the hospital. He left Goodwill. He went back to the hospital. He removed himself from the altercation. The hospital has the discretion to allow him to continue to use those level 5 privileges or to roll them back as his behavior would indicate. And since they see him every day, they determined that that incident was non-consequential. There was no reason for the hospital to discipline him further by rolling back his already unsecured movement privileges or to increase any responsibilities that he had while in the hospital.
To Justice Donnelly's question, initially you said there was some medication. My understanding is he's on consistent medication because he's returning to the hospital for its administration. But if released from the hospital, there's really no plan in place for how that's going to happen on a regular basis. In fact, there was no plan presented for that next move. Is that true?
That's true, Your Honor. And the court's witness, the facility manager for Richwood, did testify to what their facility is capable of. He testified they have 24/7 nursing care and that the nurses at the facility are responsible for administering and maintaining that medication compliance for their residents. While it was not formally written in the treatment plan proposed to the court, I know that the state of Ohio argues that in their brief. The state of Ohio was also represented by a very skilled trial attorney at that time who intentionally did not argue that point. And so I think, at least as far as the state's brief is concerned, that argument would be waived by the state of Ohio. What this comes down to, Your Honors, is that we are only asking this court to reaffirm the recent holding in Stutler, to reiterate to the state of Ohio and to trial courts in Ohio that we cannot simply wish away the statutory burden that is on the prosecutor. The legislature
So what do you do with the language in Stutler that says that these types of decisions are different?
Well, Your Honor, these types of decisions are a little bit different than someone staying completely within the hospital, but the legislature saw fit to impose the burden on the prosecutor to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the change was inappropriate.
Well, so in Stutler we said that the word may in 2945.401i grants the trial court, quote, more discretion to disapprove or modify an institution's recommendation for a committed person's non-secured movement. That was, may have been dicta, but that was a quote from Stutler, which seems to suggest that a different standard applies here. Is that
absolutely okay? That quote is correct, Your Honor, and in Mr. Hickman's case, I think, and in every case coming forward from here, it's easy to reconcile both the burden on the prosecutor, the discretion that the statute gives to the trial court, and that statement in Stutler. And it is simply that the prosecutor still must carry their burden. Trial courts, for example, in sentencing hearings.
Doesn't the record here permit us to find the prosecutor carried his burden?
No, Your Honor, it does not. The prosecutor did not contravene anything that was testified to at the trial. Dr. Goldberg was clear and unequivocal that sufficient improvements have been made to warrant releasing Del Mar to the skilled nursing facility where he would still be monitored.
The court also considered the 2021 reports. The court was entitled to consider that. I mean, that was evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So I'll go back to the question about the medication, its administration at the hospital. The statute that Justice DeWine references, that the department's designee shall send the recommendation and plan to the trial court. So I understand that someone's testifying, but there is no written case plan. There is no plan of action that's being submitted to the court that says how all of these issues, that care issues that are being facilitated by the hospital, how that is going to be carried out at that next lower level. There was no plan.
Correct, Your Honor. There was no written plan. I think that can be remedied with an order to put that into writing. However, the fact remains, the government, the state of Ohio, failed to argue that any deficiencies with the plan that was submitted to the court at the initial level.
Did the trial court articulate that specific fact about there being no plan in its denial? I have here that it was denied based on his borderline intellectual functioning, his history of violence, and need to continue treatment for intermittent explosive disorder and schizoid personality disorder. And the continued treatment part was found to be an error by the intermediate appellate court.
And the continued treatment, thank you, Your Honor. as testified by Dr. Goldberg, that intermittent explosive personality disorder has not been an active diagnosis for Delmar since 1984 or 85, according to his review of the charts. And his review, to a reasonable degree of medical certainty, is an inappropriate diagnosis, was something that he found to be not credible, were his specific words at the trial level. That is no longer part of his condition, frankly, Your Honor. And to rely on intermittent explosive disorder for Mr. Hickman at this point not only would be medically inappropriate, but I think is something that is just no longer part of the record at this time to consider. And so since it doesn't apply to him, it shouldn't be held against him. If there are no further questions from the bench, I yield the remainder of my time until rebuttal.
Thank you. On behalf of the state, Mr. Major, good morning, and thank you for joining us for off-site court.
Good morning, Chief Justice. It's really my pleasure, and good morning to all the members of the Ohio Supreme Court, all the justices. May it please the court, in this case, the 11th District Court of Appeals properly applied an abuse of discretion standard when they were reviewing the trial court's decision. In doing so, here's why.
How do we get to an abuse of discretion standard when the statute says clear and convincing evidence?
Well, the statute says clear and convincing evidence, Justice, in G2. In G2, I would agree with that analysis. It specifically calls for clear and convincing evidence, implying a de novo review of the sufficiency of the evidence at the Court of Appeals. However, Section E, which is the section we're in, is a non-secure release section, and E applies. And E is 26 lines away from G2 in the statute, but it's a world away because there's no mention of clear and convincing evidence in Section E.
But the language in G2 doesn't seem to limit it to that section, right?
I think in my reading of the statute, Your Honor, that's the only way I can reconcile Section I in that statute. Because if you apply it in a different way, you set up a battle between clear and convincing evidence standard and an abuse of discretion in I, and I just think that is an impossible way to reconcile that statute. Now, as I said, I think this is important because you get to Section I through Section E. Section I has the standard and understood discretionary language such as may and may modify. And that's why the 11th District was correct in applying an abuse of discretion standard. And in doing so, they noted that the monitoring was less rigorous than the hospital setting, that he still had a borderline intellectual function and a history of violence. Justice Donnelly, when he was asking the appellant a number of questions, asked about an error at the trial court level. I believe what the reference was, in the journal entry or judgment entry, the court erroneously found appellant needed to continue treatment for intermittent explosive disorder and schizoid personality disorder. I don't think the issue surrounded the administration of Abilify. I think that's still ongoing, and according to Mr. Hickman, it relaxes him. And I think it's an important part of this case, as the Chief Justice mentioned, that it puts the trial court in a very difficult position. And we know, looking at State v. Daniel, we're supposed to reintegrate folks back into the society. We know Rodon, State v. Rodon, we're not supposed to be looking at where they were, but rather where they are now. And in this case, it puts the trial court in an impossible position. You cannot say a trial court abused their discretion when they're requiring the petitioner to follow the law. In this case, there were mandates in that statute that were not complied with.
Friend on the other side says this report issues a non-issue, state didn't raise it, trial court judge doesn't really rely on it, as Justice Donnelly read, the phraseology was continued treatment. But there wasn't really a focus on this report. So you talk about the report, I don't find a report, but your friend on the other side says it doesn't matter, someone from the home actually did come and testify as to what they would provide.
So if I'm understanding you correctly, Chief Justice, are you asking me, is the testimony sufficient to say there's a plan in place?
Well, the report wasn't relied on by the trial court judge or the lack thereof, and someone did testify, and it wasn't raised.
Well, in response to that, what I would say is trial court judges, as you know, create statutorily mandated orders. Their journal entries aren't laundry lists. They're not findings of facts and conclusions of law. They make findings based on the standard in the statute. So it really isn't appropriate for the judge to go through a long rendition of, well, on this hand or on that hand. I'm able to argue that because, as you know, Appellate Rule 13A includes the record, and that is part of the record in the case. And it's interesting that that issue would come up because it came up in a case that this court entertained in December of last year, and it was State v. Jones, I believe, and Justice Donnelly asked a very similar question. Well, what is the record? I would argue to you that what is in the record is what's here, but you can also have the absence of something being in the record and the court relying on it. The court did not hear what they needed to hear statutorily in terms of the mandated drug compliance as well as the individual service plan. The individual service plan hasn't gotten much oxygen so far, and it's really important, and I'll tell you why. This is what the court relies on when a petitioner says, I want to let a person out, and the court says, okay, well, tell me what services we're going to place in the community to protect the community and protect Mr. Hickman and make sure this comes off appropriately. Well, that really wasn't done here. It was pushed off and said, we're going to get that to you later. You can't do that to a trial court judge. It puts a trial court judge in a horrible position when you do that. It's a problem. And then even the level of service or the level of care, and we talked about this briefly, when Dr. Goldberg testified, he said that the appellant is going to need a lot of care. He's going to need a lot of care. While the appellant is in the hospital, he sees Dr. Goldberg 5 times a week at group sessions. When he's going to be released to a non-secure setting, he's going to see a therapist once a week and a doctor once a month. That's not a lot of care. There's 30 days on average in a month. He's only seeing somebody 25 days a week. Why are the days important? Because we know as reading his report, he's nonverbal. He doesn't communicate his needs. So he has to rely on other people to ask him how you are and what are you doing. And 25 days a month, no one's asking him that.
Counsel, the state of Ohio had the opportunity to present their own expert witness at this hearing, right, to raise those points? And
yes, sir. Yes, sir. And again, that goes back to my question of what is in the record and what isn't. The appellant has the burden of production. It's his burden of production to prove these things, to place them in the record. I don't have a burden of production in this case, Justice. This is a difficult case on a lot of different levels. I don't think it's that difficult case in terms of whether or not the plan put forward was really acceptable, but it's a difficult case because it calls in the humanity of all of us in that we want people to succeed. We want these folks to reintegrate back into the community. But let's do it right. Let's follow the statute. Once this case is concluded, Mr. Hickman can reapply. It's 6 months. It's every 6 months. He can reapply. Let's get a plan together that's appropriate, that complies with the statute, and he can be reintegrated if the judge finds it to be safe.
So
yes, sir.
Assume that you had a hearing and the state, for whatever reason, chose not to put on any evidence. But the court looked at it, applied Section I. The court may approve, disapprove, or modify the recommendation. And the court said, you know, I can't approve this recommendation. I disapprove the recommendation. Does the court have the authority to do that?
Yes, because the movement has the burden of production here.
So despite the clear and convincing evidence, that doesn't preclude language, that doesn't preclude the court from, or doesn't take away the court's obligation to independently review the evidence. Is that
Well, if you're going to apply, and again, I think abuse of discretion is the proper standard here, but Justice, if you're asking me, if the court were to apply, the trial court were to apply clear and convincing evidence standard, would the state of Ohio have to present evidence? The answer to that is no, in my opinion.
Mr. Major,
the statute.
Going, if I'm reading this right, there seems to be some disagreement between counsel about whether the group home is considered to be unsecured. But again, I think that's a decision for the court using its discretion based on the evidence to determine. And if it, the court finds, as you described, and agrees with you that it's an unsecured move, then the court really, it's not really a question of the burden of proof of anyone at that point, but the court's discretion, because there are two categories where the court really has to make the decision aside from who offers what evidence, and that would be if to be released from commitment or to be moved to an unsecured supervision situation. So if that's, even if the question is whether or not the destination that's been proposed, the group home, is unsecured, I think it still would be up to the court to make the factual determination according to, reviewable according to abuse of discretion, so that we know what the court has the ability to do if it's deemed to be an unsecured move, correct?
Well, I would not agree with that, Justice. And again, the statute calls for certain findings. It doesn't require the court to list a laundry list of why they made those findings. So I understand the efficacy and logic of what you're saying, but I think the order that was issued here is in fact enough.
But do you, the two of you agree that it's an unsecured location? I didn't get that in the argument from your colleague on the other side.
I would let the appellant speak in his rebuttal time, but I will tell you it's certainly the state's position that the location is a non-secure position, and it would be considered under Section E of the statute.
Thank you. That's what I needed to know.
Thank you, Justice. I really appreciate the question.
Counsel.
Yes, sir.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chief, did you?
Go ahead.
So the easiest decision for public safety would be just to keep this person because of the horrible crime that was committed years ago. And we treat people with mental illness differently. And that our legislature has decided that that is a good thing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so what I'm trying to figure out is from the record in this case, with a record of someone who has been allowed to travel by themselves through the public, go to work, interact with the public, if we were going to look at an abuse of discretion, which means a judge just chose to arbitrarily ignore the evidence, what can you see in the record that supported, what's the strongest fact that the judge that supported the judge's decision to ignore the expert's opinions?
Sure. If I may, I'd like to answer your question just by framing it slightly different, if I may, Justice. And the way I would frame the question isn't so much what he's done in the past, because we know Rodon tells us don't necessarily focus exclusively on his past. It's a factor under Section E, but don't exclusively focus on it. What I would say to support the trial court in this case is they have the ability, one, to make sure the petitioner complies with the statute and the individual service plan and the medication prescription chart mandating their medicine was not implied. So I think as a matter of law, that applies. But to your question, what facts can they support in the record? I believe the court is well within its guidance if the petitioner came forward and said, we're going to place him in a non-secure facility, and that non-secure facility, while he's there, we're not going to give anything to him. We're not going to couch it as a termination, but we're not going to give him any services, we're not going to do anything for him. I think the trial court's well within their discretion to say, that's an inappropriate plan. And I think that's the strength of the argument of the appellant. It's not that Mr. Hickman has not made progress over the years. I'm going to acknowledge that progress, and I'm going to acknowledge the fact that in when this case is over, he certainly has the statutory right to reapply. But what I would infer the trial court would be seeking is that compliance with the statute and also a more robust plan, not just for Mr. Hickman, but the community at large.
Well, I'm a little confused. You say moving to a non-secured facility, but the hospital's non-secured. He was able to leave and go to work and return on his own, so it was he was already living unsecured. So
yeah.
You use that verbiage, so explain it to me.
Chief Justice, it's somewhat of a term of art, and I don't mean to throw it around loosely. The hospital setting isn't non-secure because he has to be there at night. He has to report in, and he's supervised while he's there. When he goes to the group home, he's not really supervised. There's somebody there, but it's not really supervision, and he can come and go as he pleases. He can't do that at the hospital. So his rights at the hospital are restricted, so it wouldn't be a non-secure setting. And I believe, I'd have to look off the top of my head, I don't know, but I believe one of the exhibits, in fact, expresses the hospital setting as being a secured setting.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I see my time is out, sadly. If there's no other questions, thank you so very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Ledinko, you have 4 minutes and 17 seconds remaining. So I'm on the last page of the recommendation from Dr. Goldberg. And the very last bullet point is Mr. Hickman will require continuous supervision and training at a residential facility due to his borderline intellectual functioning and the fact that he has never resided independently in the community. So if that's before me and I'm the trial court judge, how do I discern what he's going to receive when the very paragraph above it is, you know, under terms specified in a conditional release plan, which the trial court judge doesn't have?
Thank you. Thank you, Chief Justice. What we have in the record is that Mr. Hickman was connected with the necessary services in the community in order for him to move from the hospital. Those aren't in place at this time because he is still in the hospital. He would be connected with the Ashtabula County Board of Developmental Disabilities to give him that training, that employment through Ashcraft Industries. He would have the 24/7 skilled nursing care at the facility. He will have a curfew. He will have to check in. He will have to follow the rules of the house. Otherwise, any step outside of those lines are reported immediately to the program supervisor, which is in the transcript, and reported then immediately to the forensic monitor, who can then report immediately to the trial court so that the court can take any necessary corrective action that it deems appropriate. If he needs to come in for a new evaluation, then the court can order that on any step out of line. At this juncture, Your Honor, the complaints of the appellees just recently, those are already accounted for, and that account is in the transcript. It is in the record. It is part of this case.
Where in the transcript might I find that?
That would be the testimony of the representative from Richwood, and that would be forgive me, Your Honor, but I believe that begins around page 20 of the transcript. Now, technically, the unsecured, unchaperoned movement by statute is a form of non-secured status. It doesn't matter if he's residing in the hospital, doesn't matter if he's residing in a skilled nursing facility or in an apartment in the community. He doesn't have a chaperone. He hasn't had a chaperone for over 17 years. He was allowed to get a job in the community. He would still have a job. He would still have the same restrictions at the residential facility that he has at the hospital while seeing his treatment providers slightly less than he does in the hospital. But he does still have that 24/7 nursing care. And in the hospital, the nurses are going to pick up the bulk of the care for Mr. Hickman outside of the half hour or so that he has a group with Dr. Goldberg or any other specialized provider. The complaints of the state at this point, the record is clear and unequivocal that it is accounted for, and the statute is clear and unequivocal that they still must carry their burden. It is easily reconcilable. Trial courts at sentencing have broad discretion to impose penalties for convicted persons. However, the government must still carry its burden of proof at trial in order for the court to use that discretion. We're not asking this court to limit discretion of the trial court that is granted to it under the statute. We are simply asking for this court to hold the prosecutor to its burden dictated by the legislature.
What about the state's argument that they don't have the burden of producing by clear, convincing evidence or meeting their burden unless or until you've shown yours, that there is, that you've submitted evidence that show you should secure this recommended status?
Depends on how they do it.
Thank you, Justice. I may answer the question.
Absolutely, thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The hospital applied for his release from the hospital to a new skilled nursing facility. That evidence was delivered to the trial court and to all relevant parties, and so the production there under the statute is satisfied. That's how we got into court on this issue.
And are you saying you need do nothing more, or one needs to do nothing more?
The hospital, Your Honor, deemed it appropriate for that recommendation to be made, and so under the statute, the way that we read it is that the burden now shifts by the legislature's hand to the prosecutor to prove by clear and convincing evidence that the proposed change is inappropriate.
And you're saying that the record is devoid of any evidence on their part?
In this case, the prosecutor's office did not carry their burden. Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Justice and Associate Justices.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a decision from the court.